The Real Estate Unsuccess Stories podcast features people from the real estate community sharing real stories about their struggles, pains, and even losses during their own real estate journey. We share these real experiences so you can learn from them and build a successful journey of your own. Now, here's your host, Cody Lewis, one of the managing partners at Vindu Capital, located in Charleston, South Carolina.
Hey everyone, welcome back. I'm excited to have Boone Tyson from TNT Real Estate with us here today. Boone, how are you, sir?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Oh, listen, pleasure's all ours, sir. I really appreciate the time. I know everyone's super busy these days. For those that are maybe hearing your voice for the first time or hearing your name for the first time and want to know a little bit more about you, would you tell our audience kind of how you got into real estate, where you're from, and what kind of real estate you find yourself in these days?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Boone Tyson. I live in McAllen, Texas. And if you've never heard of McAllen, Texas, don't worry about it. Most people haven't. We are 3 hours south of San Antonio and 1 hour west of South Padre Island. So the very bottom of the state, right on the border, we're a border city. Originally grew up on a ranch in North Texas up in the Panhandle, went to Texas Tech, met my wife while we were going to school, lived in Lubbock for a few years and started flipping houses when I was in Lubbock. Yep. Got your guns up.
That's right. I got my guy. I'm a college football guy, so I know all my hand signals there.
There you go, man. Yeah, we were actually, so we were still in Lubbock when, now I'm blanking on his name. We were there when Baker Mayfield was there, and we were there when Patrick Mahomes was there. So I got to watch both of those guys play in college. That was pretty cool.
So some decent quarterbacks you got to see.
Cliff Kingsbury was still the coach. I guess he's at the Cardinals now. So yeah. Pretty cool group then.
All the power in and love to Cliff, but when he was at school at Texas Tech, I'm a Clemson fan, and he beat the pants off of Clemson as a quarterback at Texas Tech in the Tangerine Bowl.
What was that 2001?
Somewhere around there. Yeah. I tried to block it out of my head. Him and I think it was Wes Welker were just both lighting it up. So it was not a good day for us Clemson fans, but very good day for Cliff and your team.
Yeah, that was before I was much of a Tech fan, but he was a pretty cool guy. I worked in a neighborhood where he lived, and nobody had anything but good things to say about him, or anything but good things to say. But anyway, jumping back into real estate, we started flipping houses when we lived in Lubbock. We flipped a handful, did a live-in flip, and that was kind of my baptism into real estate, I guess. And we actually got a job offer down here in South Texas to pastor part-time at a church. So we pastor at a Christian church part-time, working with college and young adults. And we just kind of took it and ran with it. We were looking for an excuse to get out of Lubbock. The time was right. And we had a large landscaping company as well as some flip houses in Lubbock. We sold those and kind of had 6 months to relax and chill out. And we moved down to the valley. We call it the Rio Grande Valley, if you're not familiar with it. So you'll hear me call it the valley most of the podcast. I just got into real estate sales. A good friend of mine got me into real estate sales, got my agent's license and everything while we were in that transition period. Started selling homes, bought our first flip house 1 year after we moved here, other than the one that we did a live-in flip on. Man, since that time, we just started rocking and rolling. My brother has actually moved down, so we've got a business together. We've got the TNT Real Estate Group. A cousin of mine moved down, so he's working with us on the flips and on some rentals, and we are... As a sales team, we're doing about 100 to 110 units a year on the sales side. We're flipping about 15 houses a year, 12 to 15 houses a year. And we've got 22 rental doors right now, 2 6-plexes, 2 4-plexes, and some single family. And we are looking at trying to get another 5 to 10 doors before the end of the year. So we're just a real estate family, man. That's what we're doing now.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, listen, I love hearing that the whole family's involved. That's really cool that everyone's kind of helping out and pitching in. And it sounds like you guys are doing a lot of great stuff. As much success as y'all have had, I'm sure there have been some challenges, some obstacles along the way. And that's what we're really here to talk about today and help our audience learn. Cool. So that they can hear some of those experiences or hear your experience. And then if they find themselves in a similar situation, ideally learn from that. So if you don't mind telling us maybe an experience that pops in your head around where it was not as successful or easy as it may be.
Yeah, absolutely. Nowadays. So we got a couple of them, but the first one that really comes to mind, it's an experience that really like marked us, I guess is a good way to say it. You know, it's something we'll always come back to as a really pivotal point in our real estate career and in what we were doing. We had maybe flipped 12 to 15 properties at this point. This was near the beginning of COVID last year. We bought a property from a wholesaler in January of 2020. Great property, slam dunk deal. We knew we were going to have good equity in this property. And then when COVID started, I think a lot of people saw that's when some interest rates started to drop. And we also saw property values starting to go up because sellers no longer wanted people in their houses. We were a very reactive county when COVID first started. I think we were one of the first counties in the nation to have a mandatory mask ordinance. We did the 30-day mandatory shelter in place for anything other than essential personnel. And it was like at the very beginning, I'm talking less than 100 cases, we went into a mandatory shelter in place ordinance. And so this was right in the middle of the work that was taking place on this house. So instead of it being a 90-day flip, it turned into about a 125 to 150-day flip. Anytime you expose your, like the more time you expose yourself to on a flip, the more risk you expose yourself to, as well as additional holding costs and things like that. We had this property set to close at the end of June. So January purchase, end of June closing, we're looking at about 6 months. 3 days before closing, we had a cash buyer. It was great when we bought the property. We figured we'd be able to sell it around 150. The market had gone up. We had this thing under contract for 165,000 cash. And it was a slam dunk. We were making 50K on it, I think, 50 to 60K on this thing. I mean, maybe not quite that much. I guess it was about 45 after fees and stuff. We got a letter, just a little pink slip from the city, man, little pink slip of paper on the front door. Hey, your garage enclosure was not permitted. You're going to have to re-permit your garage enclosure or convert it back. And we had bought this thing with the garage already enclosed. Come to find out, this thing was done in 1997. 23 Wow. years later, they nailed us for a non-permitted addition. I think what happened is because the city was losing revenue during COVID, they were starting to crack down on house flippers, people in real estate that weren't pulling permits for stuff that needed permits pulled. I think they were using the dumpster, the guys that were picking up the dumpsters, because our city has a monopoly on commercial dumpsters. They will not allow other commercial dumpster companies to come in as competition. You have to rent from the city. And I think they were using some of the city employees to say, hey, you see sheetrock, you see lumber, you see building or electrical materials or AC stuff, flag it, call the city because if they didn't pull a permit. So we go to the city, it's a 2 week back and forth to get this garage enclosure permitted. And it wasn't that big of a deal. Like the red tape was not that big of a deal. We got it done in a relatively timely fashion. The buyer was still satisfied with the property. They still wanted it. We were going to have to do some repairs in that garage addition anyway, or the garage enclosure anyway. So we got the extension done. Closing was July 15th, if I'm not mistaken. We got our certificate of occupancy that morning. So I went in to close at like 12:30 PM. I immediately went to the city, picked up the certificate of occupancy so I could give it to the buyer's agent. The buyer had already signed and wired funds. So the funds were en route to the title company. And I got a call at 3:30 PM that the house was on fire. We just freaked out.
Rightfully so. Yeah. That's not a call you expected to get at 3:30 after, you know, going through closing and all that. Sure. Yeah.
Dropped a few choice four-letter words, jumped in the truck, started running stoplights and running stop signs and red lights. And we got over there as quick as we could. We had fire trucks backing everybody up a block from the house. And it was utter chaos, man, utter chaos. And on the way over there, we had the, it's just this thought, man. And I recognize, like, I'll attribute it to a God thing. I know a lot of people may not, you know, that may not be their cup of tea. I get that. But I'm just going to say, man, it was a total God thing because my mind would not have been on that normally. And there was just this thought. It was, hey, you need to call and you need to cancel the transaction. You need to see if the money's posted in the account. If it hasn't, you need to cancel the transaction, because if the transaction's not canceled, you just burn someone else's house down. You're going to be liable. Because we had permission from the buyer to complete some repairs. I mean, small stuff. They wanted to go ahead and close the transaction since it was a Friday, and they wanted the repairs done by Saturday because they weren't moving until Monday. Okay, no big deal. Right, no big deal. Even if it was in writing, wouldn't have been a big deal. So I called the attorney that we closed with, and I said, hey, man, has the money posted the account? He's like, it hasn't posted yet. I was like, don't record the deed. Do not record anything. Cancel everything. And I don't know where all your listeners are from. Texas is a closing and funding state. You can sign paperwork on a Monday, but let's say somebody's not wiring funds for closing until Thursday. It doesn't matter if your paperwork's signed. They're not going to record the deed. They're not going to do anything until funds have been received by the escrow company or the attorney that you close with, and then they disburse to all parties. And so I think that's a really important thing to note for people who may not be as real estate savvy. It's not yours once you sign the paperwork. It's still somebody else's responsibility even after paperwork has been signed. And we see that 24-hour gap, that 24-hour interim time between one ownership taking over and another owner, you know, giving up the property. We see a lot of things happen in that 24-hour period when nobody has insurance or something's in limbo. So anyway, long story short, house didn't completely burn down. It wasn't a total loss, but it was a significant loss. Meters were stripped off to prevent future issues. Certificate of occupancy was stripped from the property. The deal is dead in the water. We're looking at $60,000 in repairs on this thing. Most of the fire was localized to the attic, so that was kind of nice. So like, we didn't retain a lot of damage from 8 feet down. It was mostly ceilings and attic and roof. Everything above 8 feet was destroyed, but walls were okay. Flooring was okay. A lot of that stuff. First thing Monday morning, or I guess Friday night, we called insurance, let them know that we were going to be putting a claim in. And we started the process Monday morning. And Monday morning, when I got in touch with our insurance company, they were stating that we had incorrect insurance in place. They would not be covering the claim and would not be covering any of the damage.
Man, the hits just keep coming on this
one. Dude, it was like being a human punching bag for like 72 hours. It was every investor's just like crap storm nightmare. Literally, it was everything that you could have possibly imagined going wrong, all happening at one time. It was a friggin' nightmare, dude. It was horrible. I would lay in bed at night completely exasperated after being on the phone with insurance all day long and no progress, no headway, no feedback, nothing. So we escalated it. We got it to the third most high level, the third highest decision maker in the company. And it officially got denied about 4 weeks later. So it was a month of just like sitting there waiting while this house is deteriorating, falling apart. We also had a hurricane during that time. There was a hurricane during that time. Luckily, we didn't sustain any damage there. But it was just stuff kept going wrong. The reason that the insurance claim was denied, and I guess this would be like one of the really good takeaways for a lot of the audience, is we had not adequately, and I'll take the responsibility for it. Yes, our insurance agent should have done some things different, but I'll take the responsibility for not reading fine print and asking better questions. We had a policy that didn't cover like builder's risk. They knew we were rehabbing the property, but because our turnaround time was so quick, most of the time you can put a policy in place if it's a sub 90-day policy. If you don't have more than 90 days of continuous vacancy, you can still kind of get by with a rental policy, if that makes sense. Like, you can get by with various policies, even on a vacant property, as long as it hasn't been vacant for very long. And so our insurance agent just kind of had run this the same way they had run a lot of our other policies, and just kind of threw it under the same rental umbrella that we had some of our other properties in. Well, of course, it's a flip house. It took 5 months or 6 months instead of 90 days. And so this house has been vacant the entire time. And like 2 weeks or 3 weeks before the fire happened, we actually had received, somebody had received a letter that our insurance was going to get canceled anyway because of the vacancy. Well, nobody received it. We didn't get anything in writing. Our insurance agent didn't get it in writing, but of course they sent it. You know, nobody was let know, but they sent something. Long story short, we needed builder's risk policy. We needed a vacancy rider or a vacancy clause in the insurance docs. And we didn't have any of that in place. So that was the reason for the denied claim. And so I guess that's like something really important to pay attention to. If you're going to be doing flips, or you're going to be doing rentals, or you're going to be doing even like light rehab work on a property you're going to hold as a rental, it's probably worth getting a 30 or 60 day vacancy rider or a builder's risk policy or something like that with whatever policy you choose, just to make sure that you're covered. Because at the end of the day, man, I love insurance. Insurance is great. But an insurance agent most of the time is not your friend. No matter how great of a relationship you have with an insurance agent, yes, they should be going to bat for you. But the reality is they're going to bat for a much larger company who may say that they want to cover you. But the reality is if they cover you, they're losing money. You've got to make sure that you're protected. You've got to make sure that you have the right stuff in place. Because when it comes down to it, it doesn't matter how good your relationship is with someone. Like, they can go to bat for you all they want. You got to have the right policy in place.
Well, and I think it goes back to what you were saying is, was there some ownership maybe on the insurance part, possibly so, likely so, you know, there could have been some better communication or maybe some different type of way they could have reached out and let you know about these types of things. But ultimately it falls on us on the real estate side and the investors or the people going through this process to really know the ins and outs and educate our partners, our peers that are helping us go through this, like our insurance agents. Hey, we're not doing this thing. We're doing this thing. We're not doing the normal renter thing. This is going to be a flip. It's going to be vacant. It's going to be a longer project. It's not good in the moment to think about that. But in hindsight, it's one of those things that we go, you know what? A lot of things could have been done differently, but ultimately that's on us to do that. And I think that's a great lesson. I say this all the time on the podcast, whether you're new or you're on your 100th real estate investment or a project, you can't let those types of things fall through the cracks because unfortunately, you know, these types of things can or will happen. Hopefully not to the extent that y'all had on this house, right? I'm sure our audience has either experienced something similar or will experience something similar. And it's worth noting that you have to pay attention to the fine details because that's where you can, pardon the pun, get burned on something like that, right? It's all about the details and doing that. So I would think maybe to wrap a bow on it, you touched on a little bit on what you would have done differently or how you would have done it differently. But for those that are maybe getting into the game, they're new, they don't understand all the aspects of an insurance, advice for them as far as what they need to really pay attention to or say or do?
Yeah, I think first things first, get really clear on from day one when you're purchasing a property, get really clear to the best of your ability on what you're going to do with the property. A lot of the times, if you're buying a great deal, you're probably buying a deal with multiple exit strategies. It's something that you could immediately turn around and resell if you're buying it well under market value. It's something that you could flip. It's something that you could, you know, hold as a rental property. You could rehab it and you could refinance out of it. I don't know if a lot of your audience is familiar with the BRRRR method, the BRRRR acronym. You know, you buy, you rehab, you rent the property out, you refinance it, and then you repeat the process. What a lot of people don't talk about is if you're buying a great BRRRR, you're buying a great flip, a lot of times you have two or three other exit strategies. And so I think a goal is get really clear on day one, what you're going to do with the property. If you're clear on what you're going to do with the property, it's going to expedite all of the things that you have to do to it. It's going to expedite your rehab. It's going to expedite just getting materials, things that you have to do through the process. And you're also going to have a really good idea of what insurance you need. Okay. If you're doing, you know, paint and touch up and you're going to have a tenant in there in 2 weeks, then you probably don't need to waste the money on a builder's risk policy and all a vacancy allowance and all these other things, because there's not going to be any downtime. You're just basically throwing some lipstick on it and putting a tenant in there. So just clarity, that's the first thing. Second thing, I would ask a litigator. This was something that we learned. Go talk to an attorney and have a conversation with someone who does insurance litigation for a living. A lot of insurance litigators will actually not charge any type of a retainer because they're going to be paid based, they're kind of like people do an ambulance chasing. They're going to be paid based on the earnings from a settlement. Okay. So they'll do a lot of stuff totally free up front if they feel like they're going to win a settlement or win a case. Go talk to them and ask them, hey, who are the worst people? Who are the worst companies to try and get payment from in the event of an emergency? You'll be really surprised because it's going to be a lot of the people that you see on TV all the time. You'll be really surprised who some of the worst ones are from an insurance litigation standpoint. I would have that conversation. And then I guess like one of the biggest lessons that we learned, I'll kind of wrap this up with that. After 2 months of going through stuff with the insurance and then definitely losing, not being able to do anything with the insurance, we had a decision to make. You know, originally this property was worth 165 grand on the market, 170 grand on the market. We were in this thing about 120 at this point. We had a decision to make. What do we want to do with this property? You know, because it's just slowly losing money every single day. You know, just kind of another one of the God moments for me. I remember exactly where I was. I remember what red light I was at. And this thought popped into my head. Can we flip two houses in the time it's going to take us to finish this one out and sell it and break even? Because we knew we were looking at about a $40,000 to $50,000 remodel on this project. We're in at about 120. Let's say we can sell this thing at 170, 175. Okay. We break even if everything goes right. And it's going to be a 3 month, 4 month rehab on this thing. And so the answer to that question was a definitive, like, yes, if we can get the deal flow, if we can go find a couple great deals, we can absolutely flip two little easy ones, make 15, 20 grand a pop on them, cover the loss on this one, and then make some money or, you know, at best break even in a shorter amount of time. And so we decided to go ahead and put the property on the market. luckily we do work with a lot of investors. We lead a local RIA meetup with, 40, 50 people on a regular basis. And so we knew a lot of people looking for a flip. We were able to sell it. We sold it for right at 100 and change, I think, when it was all said and done. So we had to stomach about a $20,000 loss. But in the time, I think that was probably August, September. From September through the end of the year, I think we bought 8 other properties and we were able to sell 2 of them. Since then, we're about to close on our 3rd one. Our 3 best flips have all been picked up and sold since then. We're selling our final one, hopefully this Friday. We'll make about $50,000 on each of those, plus the other ones that we were able to either rehab or just wholesale. There were a number of them that we picked up from wholesalers, put them right back on the market, made $10,000 or $15,000 on day one. It was a no-brainer, man. Like, don't get so caught up. I think they call it the sunk cost fallacy, where you've spent so much money on something that you just keep throwing money at it, like a losing stock or a losing investment. Our best decision was selling that stupid thing and taking a loss, man. And it was a $20,000, $25,000 loss. That's a hard pill to swallow. But a way worse pill to swallow is looking up and you spend an entire year on this property, from rehabbing it the first time through rehabbing it and selling it the second time, and you broke even. Because what was the opportunity cost? What did you miss out on in the time that you were focusing on a loser? Yeah, that's probably the biggest advice that I could give to somebody is, something's losing money, get out, get rid of it, move on with your life. If you don't see a light at the end of the tunnel, get out and go throw your money somewhere else, because you'll make that money back up somewhere.
Perfect. I love that. I think that's a good enough spot to wrap up as any. So Boone, I truly appreciate the time, the lesson. I think that was super valuable, and a lot of people can resonate with that. For those that maybe want to connect with you, maybe they're in the market to buy a house, they want to learn more about flipping or anything like that, what's the best place for people to find you and get in touch with you?
Man, I'm pretty active on Bigger Pockets. If a lot of your community is familiar with Bigger Pockets, you can find me there. You can find us, I believe, our just like our TNT Real Estate Group handle on Instagram and Facebook and stuff like that. I am not an active social media guy. Any of my social media stuff that you see is either going to be one of the guys on my team or my assistant. You can reach me at Boone, just my first name, Boone, at forsalergv.com. Boone at forsalergv. I'm typically going to respond to emails within 24 to 48 hours and would love to connect.
Perfect. Well, Boone, thank you again for coming on. I truly appreciate the time and everything. Thanks so much, sir.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll catch everyone next time.
You've been listening to the Real Estate Unsuccess Stories podcast with Cody Lewis. Be sure to subscribe today on your favorite podcasting platform so you can catch every episode of the Real Estate Unsuccess Stories podcast.